Welcome to the Natural Selection Presents Grasslands. Welcome back, listeners, to a new episode of the Natural Selection Presents. We were definitely a class, maybe a family, and in no particular order, we have Naomi.
Hello.
We have Nick.
Hello.
And we have other Nick. Hello. So, Naomi, do you want to tell the listeners who we are?
We are the Natural Selection. We're taxonomists, and we want to bring our passion for nature out into the world. Each week, we meet up and we talk about the natural world. In the first part, we discuss nature news and a different research we find from the week. In the second section, we discuss a theme and how that relates to plants and animals all over the world. This week's theme is grasslands.
Cool. Thanks, Naomi. So have you guys bumped into any interesting animals or plants this week?
Yes. This week I was walking through the woods, or rather a wooded park, and I saw suddenly a herd of ungulates. And I thought to myself, oh, what are those hooved ungulates doing over there? And got a little closer look and saw it was a bunch of goats, wild goats. But they were not just wild goats. They were in a little pen in a zoo in the wooded park that was by surprise hiding around the bend of the path that I was walking down with no signage or anything leading me to expect that I would find around the bend a herd of wild ungulates. So it was quite a surprise, but pleasant.
Were they wild?
Well, they're not domesticated goats. They were wild species, but kept in captivity.
I'm with you. That's quite an impressive find. Naomi, can you beat that?
No, I definitely can't. But I did see a lot of slugs.
I feel like that's a stronger entry than you might think. Where did you see all these slugs?
I was walking along the path in the park, and actually I think I've seen them before. I don't know if it's a certain time of day that they come out, or maybe after it rains.
You recognize these particular slugs?
Well, yeah, you know, they're shady looking.
Different sections of the same path in the same park, I'm sure.
Well, they were all congregated together, like in a little clump, so don't know what was going on, but... Yeah. And then I've stood on one of those slugs on a previous day. I'm sorry, slugs. I didn't mean to.
The slug convention getting ready to dispense justice.
Yes. Yeah, that's what it is.
Slow justice. All right. Well, on that bombshell, we should probably get on with the news. Naomi, I hear you've got what? Is bad news for wasps, but maybe good news for people who don't like wasps?
Potentially, yes. So this is quite a cool piece of research. So it was published in Science, and it was published by a whole group of researchers from all across the world, really, but led by a researcher from Japan. So what it was looking at parasitic wasps and caterpillars. And it was looking at the caterpillars' defense mechanisms they have against these parasitic wasps. So in the 1970s, they found that there was a certain virus that within these caterpillars that could kill the larvae, but they didn't know what this protein was. So in this new study, they looked at this protein and they identified what it was. So it's been called PKF, which stands for parasitoid killing factor. And what's cool about this is, so it is found in viruses. And what's interesting is because it's kind of a dynamic, because the viruses are infecting the caterpillars, but the viruses don't want their caterpillar hosts to die because of these parasitoids. So it benefits the viruses to kill the parasitoids. It's a very complicated relationship and a very complicated system. But they've also, as well as that, found that not only do the viruses have it, but also some of the caterpillars seem to also be able to produce it themselves. There seems to have been some sort of gene exchange that has occurred between these insects and these viruses, which has been documented previously, that allows the caterpillars to make their own PKFs, which is pretty cool. So that was my research that I found this week. all about a very complicated relationship between viruses, parasitoid wasps, and caterpillars.
That's so weird. I love that either way, the caterpillar's not having a good time.
Well, it's having like, yeah, it has a virus, but at least it's alive.
Small mercies, eh?
Yeah, it doesn't mention what the virus, like how it affects the virus. It doesn't really, or I didn't see whether it went into that or not, but it definitely dies if the parasitoid wasp larvae come out.
And you guys have been drawn in by the insects world today, because I think, Nick, you've also got a bit of insect news.
I have some insect news, and not to give any spoilers, but I also have maybe a little bit about insects in our theme. Yeah, I've really gone insect in. I've gone insect today. And today I have some research from a team of multiple researchers, mostly based in Sweden, who were published in Current Biology last week, looking at changes in the behavior of dung beetles when affected by light pollution, which we've talked about a bit before, these amazing dung beetles. They're one of the few species that's known to navigate by the Milky Way, and they're quite light sensitive and can use those very distant stars as a way of navigating home or around. And in fact, the way that they navigate, really, it allows them to disperse in a really wide way. So if there's a dense population of dung beetles, they use the Milky Way to sort of guide themselves and go far and wide to not overcompete for resources or really to get, you know, too much dung in one place. But these researchers were doing some tests in both dark sky areas and in places with direct light pollution and indirect light pollution. So the direct light pollution would be like if a street light is shining on the, you know, field that the dung beetles were in. And indirect light pollution is that sort of glow in the city sky when you're out in the suburbs or in the countryside, but you're still kind of close to the city and you can see that orange glow. So that's the indirect light pollution. And they were trying to see if there's any behavior changes in these dung beetles. And what they found is that when there's direct light pollution, the light that's shining down on the place where the beetles are, their behavior changes to something like beaconing. And this is what you see in moths and in some night flying birds, where they're forced basically to use the direct light as their guide. It throws off their sense of direction and they go towards the light. So you see all of the dung beetles sort of moving together, and it clumps them together. They overcompete for resources, and often it leads to a resource shortage and lots of competition. And I think that can't be quite good for the dung beetles. But interestingly, they also found that they are affected by indirect light pollution, but in a different way. So because these dung beetles are so sensitive to the light of, like, the Milky Way, for example, light pollution, even when it's indirect and in non-urban places, can have a really severe impact on their behavior. They get disoriented and sort of wander aimlessly. So they don't do this dispersal or the beaconing that they get from no light pollution or direct light pollution, but instead their sense of navigation seems entirely thrown off, and they can't use the Milky Way, stars, or any sort of direct beacon to navigate, and they just sort of wander aimlessly. So it's something to keep in mind that as we keep expanding our urban areas, we're not only affecting sensitive species like these dung beetles, but also moths, night flying birds, and pretty much anything that uses the stars or moon at night to navigate and move. So I don't know, some more interesting research, but I just really want to get down to those fields at night where these researchers were doing tests on dung beetles. I think that sounds like a fun job.
Yeah, really getting their hands dirty.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Totally unrelated to what you're talking about, but I was told this week that Milky Way galaxy is a tautology, because galaxy means milky. So apparently it's called the Milky Way Milky.
I think the Greek galactos, that's where lactose comes from.
Yeah. Well, I found that really interesting. Obviously your news was interesting as well, but it just triggered a little thing in my brain. You know when those happen, you're like, oh, I learned that.
Yeah, and that's such a fun, I love those repeated ones. Like, there's a mountain near where I grew up called Picacho Peak. It means peak.
And if you speak Spanish, the Los Angeles Angels are called the Angels Angels.
A double.
Yeah. Now, you guys obviously did news on insects. Obviously, I'm the one who is interested in insects, so I have some news on giraffes. So this So this was a study by two people from Bristol University. And it comes off the back of sort of quite a few developments in the understanding of giraffes. Like, for instance, we spoke about previously how there's probably more species than we thought. They sort of pointed out that until around 2000, that giraffes were thought to have no social structure, that they were sort of completely independent. But there are a few quite interesting things about them. The other thing to note is that giraffe populations have declined 40% since 1985. So they have been dropping off massively, and they're extinct in 7 to possibly 9 countries already. So understanding their social structures could be important in their conservation. They were testing this by going over old studies. So I think they reviewed 404 different papers on giraffes and understanding how they socialize. And this might be hard for humans because giraffes are mute. So the way they communicate is not necessarily obvious to us unless we sort of stop and watch them very, very carefully. But they found that giraffes would hang around deceased members of their group for perhaps days on end, rather than leaving the bodies as other animals do, which would suggest some sort of emotional attachment. There was support of non-mothers in rearing young. Also, non-reproductive females in the group. So this is the idea that females live longer than they can produce children, which is not present in every species. It is obviously present in humans and it's present in killer whales. So they were suggesting perhaps testing the grandmother hypothesis in giraffes. And this is the idea that this reduces competition in families and it offers a way to help raise the younger children in sort of matriarchal societies and things. Now, they weren't able to say for definite that this is what's happening, but they did point out that it is very, very interesting and it's quite an unusual thing to have the females live longer than they produce children. And pointed out that this could be really bad because a lot of the time hunters, when they are hunting them, they will hunt the elderly because they are not producing females, so they're seen as non-important to the population. But if these females are actually having an effect on raising the young, then it could have quite a serious impact on the population. So yeah, understanding these social systems is going to be really, really important going forward. They even went as far to suggest that they are socially complex creatures akin to elephants or chimpanzees, but they just might be a little more subtle about it. So yeah, a kind of insight into giraffes' brains, which are notoriously hard to study because they're so high up.
I got a little bit hung up on the fact that giraffes are mute. I think I should have known that somewhere in there, but I was kind of surprised to hear that piece of information.
Yeah, their necks are too long to support vocal cords.
I think, yeah, when you said it, I was like, oh, I think it's ringing a bell, but really interesting. And also kind of, it says a lot about how, I guess, we study things, that the fact that just because they don't have a way of, we just wrote off the fact that they could be social because they don't communicate in one specific way. You know, it's kind of interesting.
I wonder if actually they speak very, very low baritone because their necks are so long. No, I'm kidding. That's wrong. But then the vocal cords would be so long, like a cello, and they'd be like, and we just couldn't hear them. No, I know. It's just a fantasy.
I didn't know you could do an impression of a cello.
Did you like it?
I would have gone, that's more theremin to me, but, you know.
Okay, my theremin is, that's my theremin.
Interestingly, that's also your ghost.
Yeah, it is, and my opera singer.
Cool. All right, well, I think that does bring our news to an end, but please join us after this short break, where we'll be back to talk about our theme, which this week is grasslands. Hello, listeners. Before we start our theme this week, I thought I'd let you know that we will now put all of the names of the animals and plants that we talk about in each episode in the description that you can find where you get your podcasts. So if you'd like to Google or find out more about them, this will make it much easier. All right, then. I guess I'll get back to talking about grasslands. Welcome back, listeners. We are here to talk about our theme, all about grasslands. And Naomi, I think, as you often do, you wanted to start us off at the very beginning.
Yes, I do like to talk about the evolution of things. So I wanted to talk about grass and when grass evolved. So just before I start, I'll give you guys a little bit of an overview of the family in particular that I'm talking about. So when I'm talking about grass, I'm referring to the family Poaceae, which is a really big family, and it's pretty widespread. It's found nearly everywhere. It's a family of monocotyledonous flowering plants and is commonly known as grasses. So it includes cereals, bamboos, and pretty much all the grasses that we would constitute that make up a grassland. Also things that you might find in your lawns and pastures. So they're a pretty economically important family because we've got cereals like maize, wheat, rice, barley, and also animal feed. And also a lot of horticultural grasses as well. So grasses make up grasslands, and grasslands such as savannas and prairies take up a lot of land area. It's estimated to be about 40% if we exclude Greenland and Antarctica. And so when did these grasses, or when did this group evolve? So up until 2005, it was believed that they had evolved about 55 million years ago. To put it in context, this is after the dinosaurs would have been around. So the dinosaurs went extinct at the end of the Cretaceous, which was 66 million years ago. And then, however, in 2005, there was a piece of research that was published, and there was a discovery made in India where they found these grass-like pitholiths. And these are basically kind of like almost like fossil crystal fragments that they find that indicate that it was grass there. And they were found in dinosaur coprolites. And if you're not familiar with that term, it means fossilized poo. So this dated back to the late Cretaceous. So this put it for a little bit earlier, which pushed it back to 66 million years ago. And then after that, in 2011, there was a piece of research that was looking at the rice tribe, which is Oraceae, which is included in this family. And so what they were looking at was they were using kind of a mix of, they were looking at genetic data, and they were dating it. And they, using this, they had a much earlier date than has been previously estimated. So they have an estimate of about 107 to 129 million years ago. However, well, with this estimate, this also kind of pushes all of plants back a little bit. But I think this is an estimate that's often getting pushed back or looked at a lot. So this is kind of an interesting piece of research as well. And then a final one as well, in 2018, there was some grass microfossils that were taken from a specimen of Hadrosaurid dinosaur. So it was in their stomach, I believe. So this indicates as well that dinosaurs were actually eating grass, which is kind of cool. So, you know, in the last 20 or so years, our understanding of the fact that grass wasn't around during the dinosaurs to actually dinosaurs were in fact interacting with grass is pretty cool. And also, I think as well, the types of grass that were found kind of indicate that grass had kind of spread out a lot at this point. So it's again kind of confirming that it does seem like if there's lots of different types, then an earlier time for their origin is likely. So yeah, that is unfortunately not a very conclusive timeline, but based on the kind of estimates from that genetic test, we're kind of thinking maybe 100 to 129 million years ago for the evolution of grass. But like I said, new research is coming out all the time, so it's an interesting one to look at.
And of course, they are technically flowering plants, aren't they? Which is, you don't often think of them as flowering plants, but they are. You wouldn't take a straw of wheat on a first date to impress a lady. Unless maybe she was a baker. But who
very
knows?
Specific. Nick, thank you.
Never let it be said that I don't know how to seduce a baker.
Nothing any of us, I think, would have ever accused you of.
I don't want none unless you got buns, hon.
There you go. Someone's on fire today.
Now, Nick, not content with finding news on insects, you've also looked deep into the grass.
I did. I'm glad, Naomi, you just laid the foundations for the grasslands for us. So I want to flesh out our grassland ecosystem a bit and talk about the insects of the steppes and prairies. So one of the cool, I was doing a lot of reading first on grasslands in general, because I thought, what exactly makes a grassland besides there being grass? And it turns out a lot of things, but that's not what I want to talk about. I want to talk about the insects. So, but to get there, there's a metaphor that I found in some of the reading I was looking at of grasslands being a bit like a house with a ground floor, a first floor, and a basement. And that most of the wildlife we see and think of when we imagine grasslands lives on the first floor. But actually, most of the wildlife that really lives in the grassland lives on the ground floor and in the basement, and most of that is invertebrate life. So we think of the ungulates and the big carnivores and even the things like the rodents and stuff. They're all on the first floor of the grasslands. But the things living on the ground floor and in the basement underground make up a lot of what's going on ecologically with the wildlife in the grasses. So in forests, many insect taxa can live above or underground. But their relatives in the grassland often have to live only below the ground to protect themselves from the dryness and the heat of the grasslands during the dry season. For example, ants in the forests often live with a mound rising high above the soil surface. But in the grasslands, similar related species of those ants have to retreat into nests that are built far underground. By the same token, you see many different insects sort of doing this like forest above ground, below ground, and the grasslands they live below. But we have something interesting when we get to grasshoppers. Adult grasshoppers do live above ground, and they're probably the most conspicuous of the common insects of the grasslands. They're bright, they're loud, they jump around, they have grass in the name, you know, they're pretty cool. I like grasshoppers. But they can do some intense damage to the grasslands. In the course of a single summer, the descendants of one locust can eat as much fresh grass as two sheep would eat in the whole amount of time. So all of the descendants that can replicate from one locust in one season will eat combined as much as two sheep would grazing the same amount of field. But the grasshoppers can travel hundreds of kilometers by air, which thankfully sheep cannot. So they can be quite more damaging.
Hot. Side note, Nick, if sheep did take to the skies, we'd be none the wiser.
Why is that?
Because they look like clouds.
Great. Good. Good. Okay. That's funny. That's going to stop me. I'm going to have to... Okay. Wow. Amazing. So during the hot, dry part of the year, the soil surface can get quite hot, which leaves mostly the insects. Can anyone guess what insects are mostly able to survive during that time of year in the hot part of the dry hotness?
Mosquitoes.
I know. It seems like it, but they actually like the wet. They reproduce in this.
Of course. I didn't know that.
I'll give you a hint. They've got a good, pretty good protection against dry heat.
Beetles?
Beetles, exactly. They've got a chitinous armor. And this is something I didn't know about beetles, despite us talking quite a bit about beetles in this podcast. Some of them, actually, their elytra have a little cushion of air underneath. And that cushion of air is kept, it's like a little climate system for them, like a little air conditioning. And it's actually where their trachea respire in and out of. So their respiratory valves that are all over the bodies of these beetles enter into that little chamber that has this pocket of air underneath the elytra, which are the wing coverings. And it's cool there, and it's 100% humidity. So they basically have a walking air conditioning unit underneath their elytra, which I thought was super cool. But they're really good at protecting themselves from the dry heat. They don't dry out too quickly. So they're sort of the kings and queens of the dry part of the year in the grassland soil. So anyway, there's that. And I just want to finish up with a little count. And this is back in the 80s, the book I was looking at, you know, as I have sometimes, you know, I do my research from books and not the internet, so it's not always up to date. But this is back in the 80s, so keep in mind this is probably grown because we're learning new things every day. But here are the numbers that I've got. Per square kilometer, about 400,000 ant nests, with about an average of 1,000 ants per nest. because we're not talking about these massive super colonies, but like, well, you know, a normal sized ant nest, thousand individuals. Then we've got about 30,000 individual mites and springtails per meter. Add to that 200 beetles, 50 flies, and around 150 earthworms. Not an insect, I know, but we're including them in the invertebrates because they're part of the cycle too. And you've got a total of around 30,450 invertebrates per square meter, plus the ants. So that's quite a bit, 30,000 plus per square meter. But keep in mind, they're mostly mites, which I don't know, if you're a mite lover, maybe that might make things better for you, but might not.
Very good. I'm so glad you did the total at the end, because it was starting to feel like a GCSE maths question. I liked your optimism that you were like, it might be more now since the 80s, because my reaction was like, I bet it's less since the 80s.
Yeah, oh, I didn't think about that. But also the 80s was just after the real, you know, the like heavy DDT era.
Oh, so yeah.
Maybe we've rebounded a bit. But then also there's that study in Germany with the airborne insects that in the last 30 years they've decreased 70% of their biomass in the airborne insects. So it's grim anyway.
But yeah, it's an amazing insight, because I suppose a lot of our insight into environments we don't live in tend to be from documentaries with sort of grand sweeping views of the landscape, which don't include mites, which are obviously really, really important parts of the ecosystem. And yes, you wouldn't really build a documentary around focusing in on a square meter. You tend to focus on things like, you know, the big migrations, which is why I did it. So this week, I'm here to talk about the Great Migration. Yeah, I was mainly focusing on wildebeest. So their real common name is the blue wildebeest, which seems unnecessary to me because you don't really often hear about red wildebeest, but they are the blue wildebeest. And they're called that because of their allegedly blue sheen on their coat, which I can't really see, but I suppose it is a bit blue. And they're incredibly recognizable animals. I think they're very, very distinctive from the African Serengeti. But the reason I wanted to talk about them is because of their great migration. They have one of the largest migrations across land in the world. Their round trip is about 3,000 kilometers. So a very, very long way. And it takes place in Africa, obviously starting in the Serengeti. And it begins with them congregating basically on the edge. And at this point of the year, they all give birth in the same month. So their population swells. And after, I think it's after 2 days, the children can run as fast as their mothers. What I found amazing after all this is no one knows what actually triggers the migration. But it appears at some point, some of them just go and the others just follow. But they can't actually figure out the triggering point on what is causing these animals at that point to choose now. And they're not alone. They are often joined, I think in front is zebras, and behind is antelope. And all in all, there's about 2 million animals that go on this migration. And the reason they're going on this is because of the grass. So grass obviously needs water to grow. You see dry grasslands, even in the summer of European countries, they often go yellow with dead grass. And obviously that can't sustain large amounts of populations. So these animals have to travel to go and find fresh grass. And the different animals can eat different types of grass. So zebra is quite good with long grass. So they like grazing in long grass areas, whereas wildebeest like short grass. So we would explain why they follow behind the zebras. It's an enormous undertaking. So I said there's about 2 million animals undergo it. And it's estimated that, I think I read it as 200, but definitely hundreds of thousands of animals will die from this migration, and not just from predation. So you see those videos of crocodiles, lions, cheetahs taking them out, but a lot from just disease and overexertion. So it is very much a migration which causes survival of the fittest. It is an incredibly challenging thing for these animals to do, and many of them die, and then they just get left behind. So unlike the giraffes, which may mourn, they just walk on and leave the carcasses behind, where they become food for scavengers, things like vultures and the like. But what they're aiming for is the Masai Mara, which is another name we've probably all heard of, very similar to the Serengeti. But it's a grassland which is further down south, and then they go back again. And they do this year on year, following the rains, which bring the fresh grass, which they can eat. And yeah, to travel 3,000 kilometers is a really, really long way. It's not the longest migration on Earth. They think that does go to the caribou. So yeah, that's sort of my musings on migrations. And Nick, I believe you had something relating to that.
Yeah, well, I didn't want to talk about the migrations, but about changing range, which I thought was close enough that we could go now and talk about that. But I started out with a sort of weird, I approach these topics kind of trying to figure out things that I didn't know before, and it sometimes takes me somewhere quickly and reasonable, and other times it takes me on long, winding routes through deserts or grasslands. But in this case, I ended up somewhere really interesting. I was looking up the World Wildlife Foundation's description of different grassland regions, and there's wet grasslands and montane grasslands and dry grasslands and lowlands, and I don't know, I didn't know there were so many, but I ended up looking at montane grasslands, and I just was clicking randomly and ended up in Iran, where there's a sort of central area of grassland that I had never heard of. To get there, okay, so we'll start here by talking about that. It's a region, it's called the montane woodlands of central and eastern Iran, and despite the name montane woodlands, it's a region of grasslands that covers about 125,000 square kilometers in central Iran. But the main sort of focus of it is in a section that's about 800 kilometers long that runs in between two desert regions along a sort of mountainous steep slope where the grasslands exist. It's particularly known for being an active center of plant speciation, but it's also marked by the World Wildlife Foundation as a critically endangered bioregion, which was something that I guess makes sense, but I had never thought existed as a classification before. But it's a region of the world that is not protected by any sort of protected areas or wildlife conservation regions or anything. So it's just there, not being protected, and is critically endangered. So what's there was my question. And the first answer that came up was the Asiatic cheetah, which I had never heard of before and thought that it only lived in grasslands and, you know, the flat Serengeti. But it turns out that the Asiatic subspecies of cheetah once lived from the Arabian Peninsula through the Near East to the Caspian region, including the Transcaucasus and desert regions in India. But now it only exists in the montane woodlands of central and eastern Iran. Its range has shrunk many times smaller than it once was, even 100 years ago. No surprise there, a lot of large animals have been finding the same thing happen. But it's a pretty cool cheetah. It runs in the grass, in these grasslands on the mountain slopes, and it's got this like sort of mohawk down its back. It's pretty cool. Take a look. But not to play the charismatic species card, though. The region is home not only to the Asiatic cheetah, but also some other cool carnivores. I know, we're talking about charismatic species, but we'll get to some other stuff in a moment. We've got wolves, something called a Manuel cat, which I had to look up and never heard of before, but it's apparently quite rare and lives in this region as well. The steppe cat, which has an amazing scientific name, Felis catus. And the lynx, which has an even better scientific name, Lynx lynx. Some great carnivores there, but they've got to eat something. And what they do is they mix up their diet with a bit of cape hair, and many different types of ungulate, including the incredibly named goitered gazelle, which actually looks pretty cool and kind of like a sighthound if you look them up, and smaller rodents, which they share with other predators like Latifi's viper, which lives in the region too. But it's not just animals. There are some pretty cool plants that live in this region as well, including some shrub cover in the genuses Pteropyrum and Lycium, which is called, in the common name is the box thorn, which are, you know, shrubby plants adapted to dry environments scattered throughout the woodland grassland areas among all the grass. There are also widely spaced trees and shrubs in the genus Amygdalus, which, anyone know what Amygdalus might be? No looking up.
Is that a part of your body?
Yeah, the amygdala is a part of your brain.
Exactly. I'll give you a hint. There's a similar related species there's two main species of tree in this region, Amygdalus, and the other is Pistachia.
Is it a walnut?
Close. It's an almond. Yeah, but the amygdala in the brain is shaped a bit like an almond. So it gets its name. But the whole region...
That's nuts.
The whole region is populated with wild almonds and wild pistachio trees. But the thing that blew my mind the most is that looking through all these carnivores, we've got these cool endangered cats. Also in this region, the common fox, which just feels a bit out of place to me. Not that, you know, it should have a place.
I won't have that. I love the common fox because of that. They live in the Himalayas. Their range is from like London to the Himalayas.
Amazing.
And they do. It's the same animal.
They're quite good. Great. Anyway, that's what I wanted to talk about here was the eastern Iran grasslands. And to call attention again at the end to say that there's really no protected areas in this whole ecoregion, which is under threat from encroaching human habitation. So
I also quite liked the scientific name for a lynx was lynx, because that's actually a good link to what I want to speak about next, which is the bison. Because do you know their scientific name?
Well, it depends what species of bison you're talking about.
Amazing.
The American bison.
Bison.
Yeah, I love
Amazing.
It.
You know, a quick side note, sorry. It's not allowed in zoological nomenclature to call something by the same genus and species name in the binomial, like bison, lynx, or gorilla. Or vulpes, like the fox. And the only way that that can happen is by a re-changing or a reprioritization of the genus name after the species has already been named. So those have to be named something else, like, say, for example, Pan Gorilla. I don't know if that's actually the genus name, but that's the genus for chimpanzees. It would be called Pan Gorilla first, and then when they realized that they weren't in the same genus, then they changed the name to something a bit more fun, Gorilla. You can do it after the fact, but you can't do it together.
So good they named it twice. Actually does work. They did name it twice. Yes. So I am here to talk about the bison. And they're an interesting, they're the national mammal of your country, Nick. Did you know that?
No, the national mammal.
Yeah.
I did not know that. And that must have been a guilt assignment.
Well, I don't know if it's just guilt, but it was so important culturally to so many people. So they are synonymous with the Great Plains in the center of America. But historically, their range would have been all the way from Alaska to parts of Mexico. So they actually went further south than Arizona. They didn't actually go that far west because it's probably too hot in Arizona where you're from, Nick. But they did go further south than Arizona. So to give you an idea of how wide that range was, which makes it all the sadder when you see their range nowadays. Because looking at the red list, they are near threatened. And the number of mature individuals in the wild, they estimate, is about 11,248 to 13,000 odd. So really not a lot. To give those numbers in perspective, they think in the 1500s, when sort of America was first colonized by European powers, they estimate that there could have been 30 to 60 million bison roaming the North American plains. A staggeringly large amount. And they were really, really important to the local cultures, which, yeah, could be part of the reason that they were hunted so extensively as well. But it's interesting to note because grasslands are under huge threat. And this is because they're really, really good agricultural land. So I think they make up about 20 to 40% of the world's surface, but they are one of the most threatened environments because of that, because they are so good at producing the foods we eat, which are generally grasses. All the foods we eat are staples, things like wheat, rice. But yeah, there's very, very, very big common species that we grow, which grow ideally in these areas. So we co-opt them and animals suffer. And buffaloes were one of these. But like I said, they were hugely important to the native populations to the point where in multiple languages in North America, multiple native languages, they actually had differing words for male and female bisons. And this wasn't just in one region. This would be across the area where they wouldn't do this for any other wild animal. So it sort of showed the cultural importance of this animal and how important it was to these people. But when Europeans came, they hunted them massively, to the point where I read this from, this is amazing for me because I was looking for papers on nature and I found one from 1900, which said, Mr. Hornaday published his interesting account of the extermination of the American bison, a work that was fully noticed in these columns at the time. The author then estimated the number of living survivors of the species at 1,091, of which 256 were in captivity and 835 running wild in British North America, the Yellowstone Park, and a few other localities. So very low numbers. Some people estimate they went down to about 500. And they're an interesting animal to be so culturally important and such a staple because they're almost impossible to domesticate. So there were no real domesticated animals in North America because there wasn't really any available. This was the closest one. There's a few problems with trying to domesticate a bison. One of them is they're big. They're the longest North American mammal. I think a moose is slightly taller, but they're big animals. They're not to mess with. They can run 55 to 65 kilometers an hour, which Nick is 35 to 40 miles an hour, which at that size is pretty scary. They are pretty much a car. And on top of that, they can jump 1.8 meters vertically. So they can jump 6 feet in the air.
What?
Yeah. So try building a pen. They are machines. Yeah, they were synonymous with this grasslands. But it's worth pointing out as well that there are some of these amazing pictures. Have you seen that picture of all of the skulls of the bison?
I was just going to ask about that, Nick. Yeah, that's one of the more horrifying pictures that was, I think, allowed in my American history textbook.
Yeah, it's staggering. You see people for scale as well of just the numbers of bison that were being killed. And in the photo I seen, it was saying bison skulls ready for processing, which is a very sinister way to see a picture processing. So that was just a sort of short history of the bison and its numbers and where it is today. So it's not as bad as it was going down to 500, but there's still only about maximum 13,000 adults in the wild. There are many, many more in captivity because, like I say, it's America's national mammal. So now they are trying to build these. So there are many, many more on private land. But in the wild, they are still down to 13,000, which down from estimates of 30 million at the low point is quite staggering. And as I mentioned, part of the problem there is human use of historically wild land. And that's something, Naomi, I think you were kind of interested in this week.
Yeah, so I'm actually going to take a leaf out of Nick's book and also read a book because I'm going to be the literary correspondent for this week. So I'm going to read you guys an excerpt from chapter 5 from the book Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind. And it's written by Yuval Noah Harari. This chapter is called History's Biggest Fraud. And so this is an excerpt that's on Yuval Noah Harari's website as well, if anyone listeners want to read it as well. And it is a very good book. I have read most of it. I'm kind of a slow reader, so I'm getting there. So I will begin. So think for a moment about the agricultural revolution from the viewpoint of wheat. 10,000 years ago, wheat was just a wild grass, one of many, confined to a small range in the Middle East. Suddenly, within just a few short millennia, it was growing all over the world. According to the basic evolutionary criteria of survival and reproduction, wheat has become one of the most successful plants in the history of the earth. In areas such as the Great Plains of North America, where not a single wheat stalk grew 10,000 years ago, you can today walk for hundreds upon hundreds of kilometers without encountering any other plant. Worldwide, wheat covers about 2.25 million square kilometers of the globe's surface, almost 10 times the size of Britain. How did this grass turn from insignificant to ubiquitous? Wheat did it by manipulating Homo sapiens to its advantage. This ape has been living a fairly comfortable life hunting and gathering until about 10,000 years ago, but then began to invest more and more effort in cultivating wheat. Within a couple of millennia, humans in many parts of the world were doing little from dawn to dusk other than taking care of wheat plants. It wasn't easy. Wheat demanded a lot of them. Wheat didn't like rocks and pebbles, so sapiens broke their backs of clearing fields. Wheat didn't like sharing its space, water, and nutrients with other plants. So men and women labored long days weeding under the scorching sun. Wheat got sick, so sapiens had to keep watch out for worms and blight. Wheat was defenseless against other organisms that liked to eat it, from rabbits to locust swarms, so the farmers had to guard and protect it. Wheat was thirsty, so humans lugged water from springs and streams to water it. Its hunger even impelled sapiens to collect animal feces to nourish the ground in which wheat grew. The body of Homo sapiens had not evolved for such tasks. It was adapted to climbing apple trees and running after gazelles, not to clearing rocks and carrying water buckets. Human spines, knees, necks, and arches paid the price. Studies of ancient skeletons indicate that the transition to agriculture brought about a plethora of ailments such as slip discs, arthritis, and hernias. Moreover, the new agricultural tasks demanded so much time that people were forced to settle permanently next to their wheat fields. This completely changed their way of life. We did not domesticate wheat. It domesticated us. The word domesticate comes from the Latin domus, which means house. Who is the one living in a house? Not the wheat. It's the sapiens. How did wheat convince Homo sapiens to exchange a rather good life for a more miserable existence? What did it offer in return?
I love when things like turn your conceptions on their heads. Nice.
Yeah, it's a very interesting concept. The chapter goes into it in more detail. That's kind of just the opening segment. But yeah, it's really interesting how, you know, humans went from kind of being this hunter-gatherer society where we moved around until kind of this agricultural society just focusing on one type of crop.
That's awesome. We like to think we're in control of our own destiny. But yeah, we are often at the mercy of many other things. And right now, we're at the mercy of time. That does bring us to an end of another episode. But we will be back next week, where we'll be talking about butterflies and moths. So yeah, do join us again next week. But for now, from everyone here at The Natural Selection, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye. So,
but before it dies, it lives. Silence after that was brutal. It was a brutal silence.
Yeah, now you know how I feel.
For the record, I will say they both laughed, but they were muted. So you could say that after every... You could just cut that vocal out and use it whenever, Nick. It's yours for the taking.
Thank you.